is brought to you by Head Start Basketball.
If you put 20 kids in a gym, right, and they're coming to work out for you and they want a college scholarship, first of all, there's going to be, 10 of them that just aren't talented enough. All right. So they might not be there. And then you get down to 10 that might be talented enough. And to be honest with you, about 6 to 8 of them aren't going to play hard enough. And then when you watch the game unfold between all 20 players and they go out there, here's a common thing I see. Nobody goes past the force field, which is the 3-point line, unless they're forced to do that. Like, everybody thinks they're going to get a college scholarship by coming in and knocking down 5 threes. And I can't tell you how many kids walk out of the gym and they feel like they got a scholarship because they made a few threes. And, they forgot to play hard. They forgot to communicate on defense. They forgot to move the ball. They forgot to run in transition. They forgot to do a whole bunch of things.
TJ Rosine has been the head men's basketball coach at Emmanuel College in Franklin Springs, Georgia for 17 seasons. He was hired at 23 years of age and was at the time the youngest college coach in the country. He has already compiled over 300 wins in his career as a college coach. TJ has 3 times been named a National Coach of the Year, 5 times the Regional Coach of the Year, 4-time Conference Coach of the Year, and twice he was named the Georgia Coach of the Year. TJ earned his Bachelor of Science in Physical Education from Reinhardt University and his Master's in Post-Secondary Education from Troy University. He played high school basketball at Oconee County High School in Watkinsville, Georgia, where he played for his father, Bob Rosine, a very successful high school coach in both California and Georgia. TJ set many school records at Oconee before accepting a scholarship with Presbyterian College. He finished his college career at Reinhardt University. TJ also currently serves as the director for coach development for PGC basketball and oversees all PGC Glazer coaches clinics. He has been a director with PGC for 8 years. He's also been speaking at clinics for years, including the Read and React clinics with Rick Torbett. TJ is the co-host of the Hardwood Hustle podcast along with Adam Bradley. The Hardwood Hustle is a platform designed to educate, empower, and encourage coaches, players, and parents. After you finish listening to my conversation with TJ Rosine, please leave us a 5-star rating and review on iTunes, Spotify, SoundCloud, Stitcher, or Google Play. Your rating helps other people find the show and join Hoopheads Nation. You can visit our website at www.hoopheadspod.com to check out more than 100 of our previous episodes, subscribe to our newsletter, or read articles by some of the great guests we've had on the show. Get ready for a great episode and make sure you're prepared to take some notes as you listen to my conversation with Coach TJ Rosine from Emmanuel College, PGC Basketball, and the Hardwood Hustle. Hello and welcome to the Hoopheads Podcast. It's Mike Klinzing here with a very special guest today, TJ Rosine from, among many other things, Emmanuel College, PGC Basketball, and the Hardwood Hustle. TJ, welcome to the podcast.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Absolutely. Excited to get in and talk a little basketball with you, find out about a little more with all the things that you have going on. And wanted to start by talking about how you got into the game of basketball when you were a young kid.
Yeah. Well, man, I've had a journey that's been, blessed beyond my own personal imagination. I think that, first of all, I grew up out in California and my dad was a high school coach out there. And he worked and helped run some camps for John Wooden out the Redlands camps. And so he was kind of a mentor to my dad. And that's where he kind of got his style, as many people did on the West Coast and probably all over the world. Tried to learn from John Wooden. And so at an early age, I just, I was around it, started picking up a basketball, enjoyed playing. I had older brothers and sisters who were going to college. My dad actually got out of, kind of interesting how it parallels my life, he got out of coaching for a little while. And there's actually a person in Atlanta that Coach Wooden had known. And my dad took a business job and kind of put my brothers and sisters through college. And then as soon as he got them through college, he went back and started coaching me. So he kind of coached, then went into business for a little while, then he coached me and then coached for a few more years before he retired. But it was just always in our blood, something we loved doing. My brothers and sisters were good players and, I had a hoop in the yard, and it was just from a really young age, one of those things that I couldn't put down. I just loved doing it. I really loved all sports, but there was something about basketball, you could always do it on your own and get better. I had a hard time doing that in football, and I had a hard time doing that in tennis or baseball. I just liked what it meant to be out on the driveway working and playing my game of basketball. You know, you got to be creative, use your imagination. It was a place of solace. It was just, you know, I can fond memories from a very, very young age.
Yeah, I can totally relate to that, being out by myself on the driveway and having the ability to get better. One of the things that I loved about basketball when I was a kid was the fact that I didn't need any friends to come over and help me to get better. I didn't need somebody to throw me the football or hit baseballs to me or whatever. It was just I could be out with the basketball, with the hoop, and really improve and be able to get better. And I think that's what ultimately drew me to the game, because it sounds like my experience paralleled yours in a certain degree, that I played lots of sports growing up, and then eventually as I got a little bit older and started to, each sport dropped off one at a time, and eventually I ended up with basketball as my main thing. So how would you think of the other sports that you played in terms of the sports specialization debate that goes on today with kids who, you know, are at 7, 8, 9 years old starting to specialize? How do you feel about that? And how do you feel that playing other sports when you were a kid impacted your development as both a basketball coach and then eventually as, you know, as a player as well?
Yeah, you know, really good question. The debate, I know people have, you know, pretty heated opinions and different sides of it. What I know is, man, I had an awesome childhood. I loved competing. I loved playing sports. I loved being in the backyard, whether it was a pickup football game or whatever it was. Like, I loved doing all that. And I can't actually imagine not doing all of that. I can't imagine having just played basketball. However, when I went to baseball practice, I usually took my basketball. And when I went to football, I usually took my basketball. And afterwards, I wanted to go shoot, you know, and that's just the way. And when I had to pick Saturday morning, you know, my dad would drop me off at some good runs on Saturday morning early and then pick me up late in the evening. He knew how much important it was to just go play against good people. And I was, as a young kid, competing on a much older court against good players, which was really, you know, beneficial to me. I being a parent now, I mean, this is how I look at it. Like, I just want my children to find their passion in life. I want them to do what they love doing. I want them to look back on their childhood and say it was full of good lessons. It was very enjoyable, and it helped me to find what I love doing. And I don't want them to live vicariously through me. And so I'm very hesitant to have any sort of specialization. Like, if there's something they want to do, you know, not every parent has fortune. I'm fortunate to help them get on a baseball team or a basketball team, be able to pay the dues, the local rec or whatever it is. And if they show an appetite for something, like my daughter is showing an appetite for basketball, and if she continues to love it and she wants to do it and she wants to play on teams where she's playing a lot, and that's the only sport she wants to play, great. If she wants to play other sports, that's great too. You know, I don't think this experience is about me, and I want to make sure my kids have some choice here. My only real point where I'm a stickler on is that you need to learn to work hard at some things. And, you know, if it's piano, if it's guitar, if it's basketball, what I don't want is them playing video games all day long. I want them to learn the value of hard work. And if that's spread 25% amongst four sports, I'm okay with that. And if it's all into one sport, I'm okay with that too.
Yeah, I think what I hear you saying is that it's child-centered. So based off what your child's interests are, as opposed to what your interests are as a parent. And I know that sometimes, as a basketball guy, I have three kids too, and it's sometimes a challenge because you love basketball so much yourself that, you know, my kids have certainly over the course of their life gotten more opportunities to play basketball and be exposed to basketball than they've been to other things. But my wife and I are very conscious of trying to make sure that, to your point, you give the kids options of things that they can do and give them as many different activities to try out and see where their passion is going to lie. And I think that's the key to having what you said, which is a happy childhood. And if you have a happy childhood, it's because you as the kid have been able to direct some choices about what it is that you're going to do, as opposed to the father or the mother who drags their kid to a particular sport or particular activity because that was what they loved. I think you get into some dangerous ground when you end up doing that as a parent.
Yeah. I mean, I think the word for me is just a valuable childhood. You know, I want them to enjoy it. I want them to have great memories. I also want them to learn hard lessons. You know, I want this is the time when we're able to walk beside them you know, when they feel pain, to be able to help them through that, when they're sad, when they're happy, to be joyful with them. And so I, you know, I'm not looking for the easiest childhood for my children, but I'm looking for a very valuable childhood.
Yeah, I think that's a good way to look at it. If you think back to your own childhood and you think about how you grew up playing basketball. So I heard you say that your dad dropped you off to find some good runs against older kids. And I think about the way I grew up, and it sounds like I was doing some of the similar things that you did, which is I was scouting around for games all over the place and playing against people of different ages and different abilities and in different parks and gyms and all that type of thing. And now it seems like those types of games in a lot of places, especially the outdoor game, has completely disappeared in favor of sort of the youth basketball system and machine that we have today. So as a college coach and as somebody who is involved in the camp side of things, how do you look at the current system of basketball compared to the system of youth basketball that was maybe in place when you were 10, 11, 12, 13 years old?
Yeah. Wow. I mean, that's a great question. I mean, I think I've also had the experience to travel overseas and coach basketball, and the opportunity to meet world-class people all over the world at coaching from at different levels, from, you know, NBA to youth to America to foreign countries all over the place. So my perspective is twofold. You know, one is, how does it compare to my childhood as a player? And two is, are we doing the best we can for our children by what we know around the world? And both are kind of loaded, you know, questions. You know, I think that, you know, first let me say just like how we're doing it around the world. Like, we don't have the best formula here in America. I'm not hesitant to say that. Like, we're not the best. And that bothers me, because we should be the best at creating valuable experiences, teaching players how to play the game in the right way, a progression of learning that progresses all children. You know, I mean, just from small things, we're getting a little bit, I mean, just from things like, you know, if you're tall, you're going to play in the post. I mean, that's just been going on forever. We're getting a little bit better at it. You know, I have issues with zone defense at a really young age. You know, I hate going to a 9-year-old game. They're setting ball screens and different reads off that. Like, there's so much more to be learned about the game. Those things will come in time, you know, and there's a place and a time for those. And they can be fool's gold, you know, like, you should set a ball screen at age 9 and have a pretty clear advantage, because the other team
doesn't know how to play it. Right.
Yeah. They don't know how to play it. And so what you're not teaching the kid is to make a read. You're just giving them an advantage. And, you know, we get to the college level, being transparent. A lot of these kids don't know how to make reads. They don't know how to make decisions. And we've kind of, you know, stopped them or not enabled them from being able to do that, because we've set things up. And so, you know, I don't want to be the guy that vents about that, but I don't mind being the guy that vents about it. But at the same time, you know, it's like, there's a lot of great things going on in America. And I think it's like anything else, that you can find the right coaches for the right reasons, and they're doing a great job. And there's also other coaches that, you know, watch NBA game on Sunday and they're trying to execute that 10-year-old on Monday, and it's detrimental to the development of our youth in the game of basketball. And so that's a problem. And then comparing it to my own childhood, I guess I probably just feel a little bit maybe sad, because I know everything that I learned as a child in basketball. Like, you know, we learned how to argue. We learned how to complain and fight a little bit with each other. We learned how to work through those arguments and complaints. We learned how to set up teams. We learned, you know, that winners stay. We learned there's just a lot of things. And we did it because we wanted to do it. You know what I mean? We did it because we all got together in the neighborhood, or we did it because we all went to the park, and you know, those types of things. I think more just a little bit sad, because there's such fond memories of, for me as a child, that, you know, I remember, you know, shooting baskets at dark. I remember the neighbors asking me to come over and stop so they could sleep. I remember, you know, like, those are all like just good things, good memories. And so I think we're taking away a lot of that in our children, to be able to make those decisions, to be able to work through things, to be able to have complicated issues and problems and deal with them, and to be able to enjoy some of the joy that the game has for us, because it was unstructured to some degree. And honestly, I do think some of the best people teaching the game have practices that are sometimes unstructured at young ages. where they're allowed to figure some things out. And I think it's a good, it doesn't have to be your whole practice, but I think it's a good part to have of practice, to live some unstructured time where they play, compete, find ways to do things and find ways to figure the things out themselves. Yeah, but those are probably my two, like 30,000 feet blush with, you know, hey, that's kind of how I'm feeling or what I think.
All right. I want to jump on two things you said. I'm going to go back to one of the things you said, and I've been a big proponent of trying to discourage, let's put it that way, the use of zone defenses at the youth level. So can you kind of lay out maybe one or two reasons why you feel zone defenses at the youth level are bad for the game of basketball and bad for the kids who are playing it?
Yeah. I mean, you know, I mean, one of the main reasons is it's 94 by 50 feet, sometimes smaller at youth, and there's a whole court to be able to be used to navigate, to explore, and to be able to learn things that are vital to the success of a player growing. You know, things like people don't think about, like just spatial awareness, the ability to take better angles, like figuring out those types of things are what make a really heady basketball player. And when young kids go in and I think this is probably different than the way there's a lot of reasons, but these are some I think are different than maybe other people feel. And like you learn how to do that. You learn how to compete. You learn how to toughen up and get a stop. You learn how to take better angles. You learn how to use the floor. You learn how to, you know, to guard your man and to be able to help. You know, and when you put them in zone, they learn how to guard one little spot, one little area. And I could go on and on and give you a list of 40 things they're missing by just guarding that spot. You know, even things from, you know, communication is more complex when there's multiple parts moving. There's just a lot of reasons why I think it's good for them. I mean, I could even go back for younger ages. I just think they need to be more active. I think they need to run around more. You could go from, you know, 5, 6, 7 year olds, right? Like even that young, they just need to be able to be moving. More than just standing in particular spots. And then you go up on each age, and I probably have a different issue with it on each age group. I'd be interested to hear what some of your issues are with it.
Yeah, so I have a couple issues. I think one is when you put kids in a zone who haven't played before and they're just getting out there and experiencing, you know, we've all seen the 7-year-old team that's standing in the 2-3 zone, or even you get up to 9, 10, 11-year-old teams who have played before. And if you haven't taught the kids the right way to play man-to-man defense, then when you do play a zone, you're not really playing a zone like the Syracuse Jim Boeheim zone that's based off of man-to-man principles. You basically get, to your point, 5 kids standing there and not moving and not really playing the game. And so they're not learning some of the things that defensively, how you'd want them to move and help and communicate and get to positions and do all the things that a good man-to-man defense requires. So that's one. Two is if you look at it from the other side of the equation, which is the team that's forced to play against the zone. So if I'm coaching a 10-year-old basketball team and I'm playing against a team that is playing a zone, one, as a coach, I don't want to spend time practicing and putting in a zone offense with 10-year-olds in order to compete against a zone. That's one thing. And then number two, if we think about what are the most effective ways to beat a zone. So I have to be able to throw over the top. I have to be able to penetrate the gaps of the zone and draw in 2 defenders and then make a pass. So right there, and I have to be able to shoot the ball at least somewhat decently from outside the zone. I have to be able to be a threat to make a shot over the top of the zone. So if I have 10-year-olds, how many 10-year-olds are capable of throwing a skip pass from one side of the floor to the other? How many 10-year-olds are capable of shooting the ball with correct form in the correct way from 17 feet over a 2-3 zone? And how many kids are strong enough to dribble in, penetrate, get double teamed, and have 2 guys collapse on them, and then make the right read and kick the ball out? And so those are probably 2 of the biggest things that I think are reasons. And again, just like you, I could probably go on, and we could just have a podcast for 2 hours, you and I tossing this back and forth. But those are 2 of the main things that I think are really detrimental when it comes to teams at the youth level playing zone.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, one of the things you mentioned there is shooting from distance. I'm not a big fan of that. I think one of the best gifts, you know, I was an average guy. I'm 6'2", 6'3", Playing weight was 180. I wasn't super fast. I wasn't super athletic. But I could shoot the ball. I could really shoot the ball. And one of the reasons I could really shoot the ball is from a very young age, my dad had me shooting close and just focusing on form. And he wouldn't let me shoot from outside. And it was my choice. He said, "Hey, listen, how good of a shooter do you want to be?" I said, "I want to be great." And he said, "Well, here's what you need to do. You need to not shoot from this spot and this spot as you grow up until you get to this age." And so if I was to play at 10 years old, my dad didn't have me shooting those shots, and I would have had to shoot those against a zone. And, so then you start doing different form from 20 feet than you would do from 10 feet or, so on and so on. So I do think it could make for a detrimental to developing somebody's shot at a young age as well.
What about the basket height? Like when you were a kid on your driveway, what was the basket height for you? Because I started out with basket when I still remember in first grade, my dad, this was before I moved to a new community, but we had this basket that was on two wooden poles, and my dad put a piece of plywood and, screwed it onto these two wooden poles. And my basket was maybe, I mean, when I was in first grade, it might have been 7.5 feet. And then as we moved, we gradually raised it up. But I think I was probably, I bet I was in eighth or ninth grade before that basket got to 10 feet. And I just remember that being, I felt like that was a huge reason why I developed good shooting form and eventually became a good shooter, because I didn't have to, crank the ball down by my waist in order to fire it up at a 10-foot basket. And I have arguments with parents and different people all the time about the need for a 10-foot basket versus the need for a lower basket. And I can make a pretty good argument that even all the way up through sixth grade, if you just played on a, again, let's say sixth graders were playing on a 9.5-foot basket or a 9-foot basket, I could make the argument that that would be better developmentally for those kids, simply because, again, what does everybody like about basketball? You like scoring. Well, it's easier to score when the basket is lower and you can shoot the ball with good form.
Yeah, no, I mean, all good reasoning there. I mean, I think, I similar to you. I mean, we had a, like a metal basket, and I remember lowering and raising the goal was way harder back then than it is now.
Absolutely.
I remember having two ladders out there and WD-40 and, getting to that spot. And I don't really exactly recall what age I went down or up, but I do remember, always being like you said, like the spatial awareness. Like if I shot on a 10-foot goal, maybe it was from 8 feet, right? And if I shot on a 9-foot goal, maybe it was from 12 feet. It was always relative to where was I able to keep my form. And if my form had to change for me to be able to shoot a good regular shot, that was too far. And so if that was 15 foot on an 8-foot goal, but it was 6 feet on a 10-foot goal, that was just it. That was, hey, you're changing your form. We need to go back to being simple and basic and shooting the basketball. And so we did have a lower goal. I don't remember what age that changed from. I just remember it taking us 3 hours to raise it up a foot every year. But yeah, I think all of that, just age stage appropriate in the development of anything, and specifically and especially a shot, is really important.
It totally is. And I think that there's ways that you can do that. The problem is a lot of people either A are not educated about what the benefit of a lower basket, or to your point, shooting in closer so that you maintain that good form. So people aren't aware of that. That's a better way to do it. And then even when they are aware of it, a lot of times they're resistant to it. And so to go along with that, I have another question that I want to ask you about youth development and just get your take on it. How do you feel about the playing 3-on-3 with younger kids as opposed to having these 7, 8-year-old travel and AAU teams where they're running up and down the floor and pressing each other, and you spend a lot of time running between the top of the keys as opposed to 3-on-3? So I've made the argument that I think 3-on-3, if we could get, and I'll just throw an age out there, you could probably quibble with where we stay, but I said if we played 3-on-3 basketball up through fifth or sixth grade, and that was all we played, we didn't play any 5-on-5, that ultimately I think the skill level would be higher for those players when they finished with that 3-on-3 system, simply because, one, you get more touches on the ball. If you're a kid who's a post player, or you're not the best player on your team and you're playing a 5-on-5 game and you play one of these 1 hour AAU games, how much are you actually touching the ball? So in a 3-on-3, everybody's involved in the action because you have more 3-man actions, even when it's a 5-on-5 game. And then you mentioned earlier about the spacing and understanding you know, where to move and how to go and where to cut and what the angles are. And I think all those things, because the floor is more spaced and more open in 3-on-3, it allows you to make more of those types of decisions because, again, the floor is just more spaced and there's less people involved in every action. And so I've been a big proponent of we need to start really working on 3-on-3. So is that something that you see? And I know it's a difficult to break through kind of the system the way it is, but I would really love to see more 3-on-3 basketball out there.
Yeah, no, I mean, absolutely. I think this is – there may be more than one way to skin the cat, and I think 3-on-3 is a really good way to think about trying to skin that cat, you know, trying to make it effective. Because what we want – and you know, I'll be really honest. Like, I've been a competitive college coach now for 18 years. I was a head coach at the age of 23, and so I've been in that world so long that – a lot of times I have to think about, well, oh, what would I do in this situation or that situation? Sometimes there's a lot better people to be able to answer that than me. But now as my children have started to grow up and I'm experiencing it and I know what the end of their career might look like or where they possibly could get, and I look at where they're at right now, what do I want for them to be able to develop, you know, as a player? The first thing, I remember this when I was in college. Dr. Epling being, you know, when I decided to be a physical education major, him saying to me, you know, one of the goals of making sport enjoyable is that they develop a skill. And as the skill gets better, they enjoy it more. And the more they enjoy it, the longer they do it. So there's this system to learning a skill, to getting better, and then you enjoy what you're doing more. And the more you enjoy it, the more you want to do it. So this continues to build up on each other. And I think anytime you throw 5-on-5 pressing out there, or you throw a zone out there, or whatever, we diminish their ability to get better at the skills. And therefore, that sense of improvement can be slower, which can be frustrating to a lot of people. The enjoyment isn't as much. And so people either walk away from it, or they just kind of conform to whatever is being done. But in a 3-on-3 setting, you're going to be forced to have better skills. You know, you can't hide, you can't run. It's not going to be just about running, jumping. So I think that's one way. I think there's a lot of ways, but I think 3-on-3, and I experienced my daughter playing in a 3-on-3 league this past summer. And I thought it was great. I thought, because when her first experience 5-on-5, she's big, she's tall, and they put her down on the block, and I cringed every day. I'm like, she's got to learn how to dribble. She's got to learn how to shoot. You know what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, and then they played 3-on-3, and there was no choice. Everybody had to touch the ball. Everybody had to move. Everybody had to get around. And I thought, wow, this is really, really good. You know, and that's what you want as players. And we say it all the time at PGC. Way too many players are spending time, you know, trying to get seen and not getting better. And because we're in an exposure world, and everybody's trying to go get a college scholarship or trying to, you know, whatever it is that they're trying to do, they're all focused on exposure, and therefore we're diminishing everything about the game that makes players better. They're not focusing on things that they can do to get better. They're not focusing on the intangibles of the game. They're not focusing on the skills of the game, and they're not getting into situations like that. They're not getting into 3-on-3 and moving without the ball. It just becomes, you know, dominant by what will help me to get seen. Where people can notice me, and that never develops the best skills.
So what are the challenges that you see then as a college coach, as your guys come in and you're recruiting players and you're out and, you know, you're on those circuits and seeing those guys playing in AAU tournaments and that kind of thing. So when guys come in to your program at Emmanuel, what are some of the challenges that you face? And again, not talking about one specific player, but just in general, the guys that come into your program, what are some of the things that you'd like to see them across the board maybe do better, or maybe things that they did better a while ago, things that they do better now? So just kind of compare or talk about what guys look like when they come into you as freshmen.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a really good question. I think it's really helpful for people to know this as well. I mean, I'll try and keep this one short because this could be a podcast in itself as well. You know, I think the first thing is I have no major issue with AAU. I've seen some phenomenal AAU coaches. I've also seen some really bad ones, you know, and there are people out there trying to make players better and give them a great experience. And there's also people out there self-serving, just trying to get exposure, so on and so on, you know, and so there's good ones and there's bad ones. And I'm sure that's the way it is a lot in life. Nothing particular against AAU basketball. I'm just very for people that are doing it for the right reasons. And one of the things that I notice, and it, you know, could be trickle down from AAU, could be trickle down from any level when players come to college, I mean, I'm gonna actually just walk you through. We'll have players come up here and work out for us looking for a college scholarship. And people have no idea how competitive it is to get a college scholarship to a competitive program or any college in America. I mean, you're looking for three or four kids, and we're getting, 5,000, 8,000 emails a year, and we're trying to find the three or four best kids from those 8,000 emails. And
Absolutely, yeah.
so it's really, really difficult. And here's where most people miss. Like, you can almost just write them off in the very beginning. This is why talent does win out, because if you put 20 kids in a gym, right, and they're coming to work out for you and they want a college scholarship, first of all, there's going to be, 10 of them that just aren't talented enough. All right. So they might not be there. And then you get down to 10 that might be talented enough. And to be honest with you, about 6 to 8 of them aren't going to play hard enough. And then when you watch the game unfold between all 20 players and they go out there, here's a common thing I see. Nobody goes past the force field, which is the 3-point line. Well, and unless they're forced to do that. Like, everybody thinks they're going to get a college scholarship by coming in and knocking down 5 threes. And I can't tell you how many kids walk out of the gym and they feel like they got a scholarship because they made a few threes. And, they forgot to play hard. They forgot to communicate on defense. They forgot to move the ball. They forgot to run in transition. They forgot to do a whole bunch of things. But they just equate success to making a three or getting a dunk. And so, because that's been so glorified, and we watch that so much, that's what they see as success. And I mean, honestly, of those 20 kids, if one of them came in there, I mean, like, there's two ways to stand out, just being really transparent. There's two ways to stand out. One is just your talent just supersedes everybody else in the gym. Like, you could just tell this player has better. That's one way, but that's only for the very few people. Like, not many people can do that. But the other way is that you just compete and have intangibles that stick out like a sore thumb. And honestly, that's what we try and teach at PGC. We're for the coach. We're trying to send back more coachable players that play the game the right way and they think the game. And very seldom do I have players come in here for a workout that they're thinking the game, they're communicating the game, they're sharing the intangibles of the game, they're playing their tail off. They go, because even if they're maybe don't have the skill set, you still look at that player and think, man, I might could work with this because they're rare. But most of the time, that doesn't happen. Most of the time, out of those 20, maybe one sticks out because of their talent level, and maybe one or less sticks out because of the other stuff they bring to the table, their motor, their intangibles, and stuff like that. And so that's one problem. That's one issue of things you see. And then, I think the other, other couple of things that you see is just a mindset of not being urgent. Like, they play so many games. They're just not urgent. They don't understand. And I get it. I mean, if you play 8 games in a weekend, can you go as hard as you possibly can all the time? And people think that's good for them. I don't think it's good for them. When we come in and practice our college team, and people are like, how long is practice? Practice is as long as we can go hard. When there's a drop off, then I'm not going to keep going through, because then they start building bad habits. They learn to play through just being tired, and then they start cutting corners. Like, I watch them play pickup after the season or before the season, and I'm like, that's a complete waste of time, right? I mean, I hope they're having fun, and they need some of that to go do some of the things that are fun in the game. But at the same time, like, they're just not doing, they're not getting reads that you would get in a real game. There's no help side defense. Nobody's rotating over there. And so it's just unrealistic.
Registration is now open at www.headstartbasketball.com. For this summer's Head Start basketball camps. We'll be hosting camps this summer in Strongsville, Westlake, Avon Lake, Oberlin, Brunswick, Highland Heights, Mentor, and Hudson. At Head Start Basketball, we care deeply about making a positive impact on the lives of young basketball players, both on and off the court. It's through building strong relationships with our players, parents, and coaching staff that we are able to use the game of basketball to enrich the lives of those we interact with, both inside and outside of our organization. We believe that our attention to detail, our growth mindset, and our commitment to lifelong learning allows us to help our players achieve their fullest potential. We are passionately committed to providing players, parents, and coaches with everything they need to reach their goals. These core values run through everything we do. Check out our website, www.headstartbasketball.com, and discover why you should attend a Head Start basketball camp this summer. Hope to see you there.
Yeah, I love two things you said. One is what you started at the very beginning with, and that is that people have no idea. And we say people, I think we're talking about players and their families. People have no idea how good you have to be to play at any level in college. And that's one of the things that's sort of been a consistent theme with all the coaches that we've been able to talk to on our podcast, is just guys will say, you know, this kid wants a scholarship, or this kid is, you know, thinks he's going to go here or going to play there. And they just have no idea that they're just not good enough. Like, go watch a Division III college basketball game and look how high the level of play is. And so that's number one. And then I think the other thing that stood out for me, which I find to be totally interesting, because just like I'm sure you were as a player, I was not the most talented guy athletically getting up and down the floor. I wasn't playing above the rim. I wasn't beating anybody in a, you know, in a 40-yard dash. Those were not my strengths. But what I was willing to do was play extremely hard. And because I was willing to play extremely hard, that afforded me some opportunities that, you know, other people who may have had more physical, quote, athletic talent than me didn't get. And it just blows my mind that that is, and I know it's true, but that's a separator of what can make the difference between whether or not a guy gets an opportunity to play in college or doesn't. Because to me, that's always something that is under my control. I can control how hard I play, and I can't control how much talent I have, but I can certainly control how hard I play. And the fact that players don't see that, don't recognize it, don't do it, is it always amazes me.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, I mean, there's a part of this. I was out at the junior NBA meetings last year, and don't remember who it was, shared a really interesting, might have been Arnie Davis, I think, former Secretary of Education.
Yeah, Arnie Duncan.
Arnie Duncan. Yeah. And I think that's who it might have been. But there's a big trend right now that's kind of heartbreaking to me, is that more and more middle to upper class people are starting to play college basketball. And that shouldn't be heartbreaking, but it's disappointing for this reason here, is because the game has changed from out in the park to everybody's got a trainer, you know, and there's nothing wrong with, you know, having a trainer and ability. It's just, there's a lot of people that can't afford that, right? There's a lot of people that can't afford to get trained. And then everybody that they would play with is now getting better training than they had before. They were out there and is playing. So there's less and less of those people that can afford it. They're getting college scholarships. And so to me, what I've noticed in the trend of my 18 years as a head college coach is the pool of okay to mediocre is bigger than it's ever been. Like, there is thousands and thousands of good players out there. Where when I was growing up, there was a lot of good players, but I mean, I feel like when I watch it now, there's a lot more good players out there.
So here's what I've said to that. And let me ask your opinion on this one, because you go and probably see a lot of high school games. What I've said to other coaches, and this is what I've noticed, is that if you think about players today and you think about an average high school team, so let's say there's 12 kids, mm-hmm. I think players 6 through 12 today on a high school team are way more skilled than kids 20 years ago. Player 12 on a high school team when I was in high school, and now that's longer than that ago, but you know, those kids weren't very skilled. Like, you might have had the football offensive lineman who was 6'2 and was willing to go around and bang out some people and, you know, set some screens and rebound. Whereas now, players 6 through 12 have probably been with a trainer. They can all handle the ball. They can shoot. Now, that doesn't mean they know how to play, going back to what we talked about. They may not understand the game itself. But just from a skill standpoint, I think they're a lot better than the kids that we saw 20 or 30 years ago. Do you think is that kind of the point that you're making here?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely true. I mean, which is a good thing that there's more better players out there.
For sure. You know?
And so I think that's great that, you know, you're not filling out the end of your roster with, I hope, and this, and the other. You got good players. Everybody's got more and more good players, and 6 through 12 is better. I'd probably even argue that, you know, 3 through 5 is better. Than it used to be. I mean, I think, you know, there's 1, 2, 3 best players every school. It's probably similar to when I was growing up, that they're, you know, good is good, you know, but I think it's great for the game that more people have caught up and more people have come in there, but the more mediocrity there is, and mediocre is not a good word. It's just, because I'm not saying they're just mediocre. They're not any good. They're good, but just
the middle of the bell curve, let's say.
Yeah. The middle of the bell curve is just, bigger than it's ever been. And so there's a lot more people that believe they can play in college, right? Which isn't a problem, which is okay. It's just that they need to understand that if they really want to do that, there is still another level of separation they have to find. And that's the separation I think that I'm talking about, and other coaches have told you on here that there's it's harder to sift through, because I'll watch, you know, I'll watch like this time of year, I'll watch 30 videos a day. And when I watch 30 videos a day, you know, I'd say 15 years ago, I could watch 20 and be like, nope. Right. And now I'm finding 20 that I'm thinking maybe, you know, I got to see them live. I got to find them out. But maybe there's a lot more maybes than there were for me 15 years ago.
And so then does it come down to, as you look at those maybes, then you're starting to look and evaluate some of those intangible things that you've talked about, I'm assuming.
Yeah. I mean, you know, it's such, and nobody's not telling the truth, but 90% of parents that come in here tell me that you're going to love my child. They're the hardest working person. they live in the gym, you know?
Right.
And to be honest with you, they may be the hardest working person in their neighborhood, right? Like, and they may be out there shooting, they may be, but there's another level of commitment. Every level you go up, I mean, there's another level of commitment. And a lot of times when I hear that, it doesn't always pan out, you know, of the 90% that tell me that, you know, we're still the same ratio as everybody else. There's a few that work harder than everybody else. And, you know, and so I think getting rid of that misnomer a little bit and like just getting more realistic about like, what do I got to do? I think there's other things you got to do. Like I think specializing in a skill is really important. Like if you can do something better than everybody else, you've got a chance. You know, I mean, shooting was the equalizer for me, and I still think it's probably the number one equalizer in the game. But occasionally, if you can defend better than everybody else, if you can lead better than everybody else, because there's going to be a lot of times when I see 20 players that are equal. And so what is going to be that separator? Is it shooting? Is it their intangibles? Is it their effort? Is it their, I mean, and sometimes it's two of those things. Sometimes it's three of those things. Sometimes it's one of those things that separates them.
Do you think that that's, I think that's very interesting, because I go, again, kind of drawing on my own experience. When I went and had an opportunity to play at Kent State, and I went there as a freshman, and I came out of high school and was a scorer and probably didn't play a whole lot of defense if I went back and looked at my high school videos. But I got to Kent and realized that, hey, if I'm going to get on the floor, my team, certainly when I was a freshman, I didn't play very much. But then when I was a sophomore, there was an opportunity. But I saw the kind of the lineup and who was around me, and I said, boy, this team's not going to need me to score, but they might need somebody who's going to be the best defender. And so I just flipped my mindset and kind of made an analysis and said, hey, I got to become a defensive player. And I'm not sure how many kids are out there that are willing to make those kinds of decisions of, hey, I'm going to step away from the glamour skill of being a scorer or a shooter, which if you're getting an opportunity to play in college, chances are on your high school, at the high school level, you're probably a pretty good scorer. So if you're going to make that adjustment on the college level to, hey, I'm going to be a great offensive rebounder, I'm going to be the lockdown defender on the perimeter, or whatever skill it is that you decide to focus on, I would guess that that's kind of a hard sell for kids to understand, because they just have been in this certain mentality of being a scorer all through, you know, all through their career.
Yeah, I think that's spot on. I honestly, but it's no different. I think there's a lot of hard sells when you get to college. And I think there's probably a lot of hard sells when a kid goes from ninth grade to 11th grade, but I only know the college sells more. You know, I mean, it's hard to sell shot selection. You know, I mean, most of these players have a lot of freedom because they're the best scorer on their high school team. And they were allowed to shoot this shot and that shot, and maybe rightfully so by their coach, you know, like, hey, that might have been the best shot for their team. But now you got other people that can score the ball, and that's not the best shot. You know, I mean, the more and more we watch Harden and Steph Curry and some of the crazy shots they take, right?
Like more comes a little kids, unrealistic, right?
Yeah. Yeah. And you know, I have to sell to them all the time. They've earned the right to take those shots. You know, they've put in that time, that effort and that work and, you know, all that kind of stuff. But a lot of them got away with shooting that before. And like I said, I'm not saying it's a bad coaching decision, because maybe that step back three was the best option from that player, better than your third player taking a spot up three, you know, so I don't know. I wasn't in each one of those situations, but yeah, it's a hard sell to play defense with great intensity every single minute. It's a hard sell to take great shots. It's a hard sell to play less minutes than you played before. It's a hard sell, but to your point, it does seem to be getting harder to sell those things, you know, because and that goes back to maybe a little bit of the way we're treating summers and things like that, because you know, I think it was just a little bit more about winning than exposure as we were growing up. And I mean, exposure was just starting to become more popular,
right,
as I was growing up, but it was really just still about winning. And now, I mean, that summer, I'm not saying kids don't want to win, but if you were to ask their parents, what's more important to you, a scholarship or winning, they're going to say a scholarship. And if you ask most kids, what's more important to them, if they're being truthful with you, I'm thinking they're probably thinking scholarship is more important to them.
And I think, too, that we play so many games. You mentioned earlier about playing 8 games in a weekend. If you play 8 games in a weekend, how important can any one of those games be? Are you laying it all on the line for each of those 8 games? Versus I think about my own experience when I was a kid, and you know, in high school, we played a 20-game regular season. Each one of those games meant everything to me at that point. Yeah. And even in the summertime, like AAU was just kind of starting out, and you know, maybe I played in 1 or 2 tournaments in the summer, but those things mattered. I still have a snapshot of me after a game when I was probably 13 or 14 years old, laying against the bleachers, just in tears, sitting next to a teammate, you know, over a game that today, you know, kids lose that game and they're like, hey, where are we going to eat? And because there's another game in an hour or two. And I think the rarity of games when we were younger, I think that impacted the desire to win. I think the other thing that impacts the desire to win kind of goes back to what we were talking about earlier in terms of sort of playground basketball and pickup basketball disappearing, is when you're playing pickup basketball, if you don't win, you got to sit. And if you're at a park or a gym where there's a lot of good players, well, you can bet there's probably 4 or 5 teams waiting. And now you're going to sit for an hour, hour and 15 minutes. So you better be sure that you're doing everything you can in order to win that game. And I think that's something that also has detracted from that intense desire to win that maybe isn't as prevalent today as it was in the past.
Yeah. And, you know, and there's a lot of wonderful things about this generation, you know,
I agree.
A lot of wonderful things about these kids and they're coming up. I think what we really are talking about is not really what they're not doing. It's just, how do we navigate this? You know, like, how do we make these things better? Because these were strengths of ours, but tend to be weaknesses of theirs. And they have strengths that we didn't have, you know, were weaknesses of ours back when we were playing. So it's just, you know, and it's going to continue to change. You know, 5 years from now, we're having a different conversation. And in 10 years, we've got a new set of problems. And I think just navigating those to make sure that young people are learning the things they need to learn and staying away from things they need to stay away from. And I think the question comes, is our structure in America the right one to make that happen and to make it healthy? And I don't think many people would argue that we don't have that in structure. We don't have that place in place right now.
So what are 1 or 2 things that if you could wave your magic wand and change sort of the player development system that we have here in the United States today, after having seen what people do in different parts of the world and just having your own thoughts about how your kids that come into college, what you'd like to see them do, what are 1 or 2 things that you'd like to see change that would make the game better for everybody? Because again, obviously what we're talking about here is we want the game to be better for the kids who are playing it. We want the game to be better for the coaches, and we want the game to be better for the game itself because, again, of the passion that we all have for it. So what are 1 or 2 things you think you could do to really improve our system?
Oh, man. gosh. Well, if I could wave a magic wand. So Dick DiVenzio is the creator of PGC. I don't know if you've ever read Think Like a Champion or Good – or Stuff Good Players Should Know.
I've carried around Stuff since my dad got me a copy probably when I was like 10. So I've carried that thing around. It's still sitting in my shelf. I can see it from where I'm sitting. So,
okay.
So absolutely.
Yeah. So first of all, he was way ahead of his time and probably one of the most brilliant minds I've ever read about, known, heard in all of basketball. And, you know, he had a dream one time, this thing called Metamagical Basketball, right? That's what he was going to name it. And basically it was a lot of leagues around the country that were based on habits. And so for instance, like one of the habits we teach at PGC is every time your hands touch leather, you've immediately got to peek at the rim. And if you don't peek at the rim, it's a violation. It's a turnover. right? And so if I could do two things to change what's going on in the world of basketball, I mean, a couple things. I mean, number one is I would be really clear on the intangible expectations. So, for instance, it's an automatic violation if you slam a ball. It's an automatic violation if you do, you know, whatever towards a teammate. Like, the coaches have to manage it. You know, if you don't give a high five on your way out, we'd have to make up what those rules are, right?
Right, right.
But what I would do, first of all, is just teach them the right way to play the game. Because basketball is the greatest game in the world, and it teaches us so many great lessons. But if we as coaches and overseers of the game do not pay attention to those things, do not hold kids accountable to those things, they'll never learn the lessons that basketball has to teach. So I would have a set of standards, a very simple set of standards, you know, like, in fourth grade, every time there's a sub, you must call out their name, high five, and everybody sprints on and sprints off, you know, just little things like that. Just learn how to do little detailed things well. Maybe every time your team makes a bucket, everyone's got to stand and clap. I don't know what those things are, right? But I would have a certain set of rules for each one of the age groups, and I'd have to do some study on age stage appropriate, but I would have something in the intangible category. The second thing I had is something in the habits category where, at age, in the fourth grade, every time your hands touch leather, you must peek, or it's a turnover and the ball goes to the other team. And you would just build up different habits. You know, in sixth grade, every time you catch the ball, you must come to a 2-foot jump stop to show body control, or it's a violation. So I would have rules, just maybe the regular basketball rules, plus two or three rules that are unique to their age group that are going to make them better players. And it would force them to have line. The other third thing I would have is curriculum. You know, for instance, like, there's no zone defense allowed until ninth grade, right? You can't set a ball screen until eighth grade. You can't do, you know, whatever it is. I mean, you can't press, up until sixth grade. And again, age stage appropriate. There's people that are smarter than me out there that know age stage appropriate better than I do. But what I would do is I would build intangibles. I would build habits and rules according to that. And then I would also put guidelines to when you can incorporate different things by different age groups. Those are the three major changes that I would make.
Yeah, I love that. And I think to go along with that, and this is the piece that I think always becomes a challenge, is if we were able to do that, and even with the magic wand, there's still a tremendous amount of coach and parent education that goes along with that. And what I found just in my own experiences coaching my own kids is when I've tried to teach the intangibles, teach life lessons, work on developing the character of my players, you have to really do a good job of explaining what you're doing to parents so that they understand what it is that you're doing and why it is that you're doing it. Because parents, or even other coaches in a lot of cases, will look at you and you have time on the floor and you're stopping and talking about why we need to give a high five, or we're talking about why we need to thank the passer, or we're talking about just in general, hey, why is honesty important on our team? And people are looking at it going, well, we have time here on the court. Why aren't we shooting? Why aren't we dribbling the ball? And I think you're making the point that all of those intangible things are equally as important. And I always make the case that they're equally important not only to your success as a basketball player, but they're also equally important to your success ultimately in life. And I try to explain to parents that, look, even if your kid ends up playing in college, or holy cow, they end up playing in the NBA somehow, don't you still want your kid to ultimately be a good person who cares about others and wants to make the world better and has done more than just play basketball? And look, I love basketball as much as anybody. And I still think that the game not only gave me basketball, but it made me into the person that I am today. And that's something that I try to pass along to the kids that I get a chance to touch. But at the same time, there are still parents and coaches out there that are resistant to those ideas. So how do you go about overcoming that? Because I know you're a big believer in fighting for your culture and making sure that you're doing all those intangible things and teaching the character piece of it. So how do you go about doing that day in and day out at Emmanuel?
Yeah, I mean, well, I think first of all, culture, I've said this a couple of times, but culture is no different than a really well-functioning family. You know, like when I think about, you know, my wife and I, we've been married 15 years, we have 4 children, we love each other. And I think we have a pretty strong culture at our home, but it's not absent of argument. It's not absent of disagreement. It's not absent of tears. It's not absent of all the emotions that a family and people that love each other show, you know? And so I think one of the things that I see happen a lot of times when people are building culture, they're trying to build it according to obedience, you know, like let's do this. So they do this, let's do this. And there's always something tied to it. But really one of the things that I think we try to do here in Emmanuel is, and this is some of the best advice I've ever been given, but whether it's on the court or off the court, we're going to come across 100 teachable moments a day. And how many of those moments are we willing to teach? How many of those moments can we actually go out there and parallel life in basketball? Can we parallel being a good person and being successful? How many times can we teach those lessons? And I think that that's probably the thing that we do show the most diligence in, is not being afraid to stop things to teach the lesson that became present to us. And I never know what those lessons are going to be, but I know that basketball is unbelievable at revealing lessons on a daily basis. And so, you know, knowing that basketball is my vessel and being able to be in those situations and be able to learn how to teach those better every single day, every month, every year, I think is an honor and a blessing to be able to do that for young people. And I'm constantly on the lookout for teachable moments.
How intentional do you have to be in order to make that happen? And I would guess that when you started, you probably were not as intentional about being able to do those things and teach those lessons and pick those things out. So day to day, and I can speak to this as a coach who's coached at several different levels and not ever at the level that you've been able to coach at. But I find that if I'm not intentional about something, that it's easy for me to overlook it. So how much do you have to continuously remind yourself, remind your coaching staff that those lessons, those intangibles are a huge part of what you're trying to accomplish?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I mean, I think that a lot of it goes in line with what you source your reason for doing what you do, you know? And every year that I coach and I get older, my why behind coaching becomes more evident to me. And it's to change lives. It's to impact young people, right? And the more that becomes evident to me, the more I look for those lessons. And so there's a lot of times in my life, especially earlier in my career, where I almost had to write that down on a piece of paper to remind myself to care about that stuff. Because what really mattered at the end of the day, I knew that was important, but I was really thinking about winning.
Right.
And now as I've gotten older, also, I've realized that the two things are hand in hand. Like, you know, it's funny, you know, like people always want to like, well, you know, I got to get my team to win. I got to get them better. And people ask me, well, how do you do that? The very first thing I would say is invest in them as people, you know, and help them to see these lessons, help them to love and to be loved, help them, you know, all of those things. And so it's kind of an oxymoron. You kind of think about like, well, I don't have time to teach all of these things because I got to win basketball games. And I've seen that sick cycle play over and over again from a lot of really good coaches where I got to win, I got to win, and I got to win. And they lost their purpose. And in turn, the one thing they didn't want to happen happens. They lost a ton of games, you know? And so it's a bad cycle. It's ugly. And I think it's important to source it from a place of like every single day, like what am I trying to get accomplished here? And I found the more lessons I can teach about life and the game of basketball continue to translate into us being a better team. And so the other thing is, it's just like training your eye. Like somebody told me there's 100 teachable moments every practice. And this was a seasoned veteran, a wise person, a wise coach. And there's 100 teachable moments. And I was at that time, 25 years old, I was seeing one or two.
Right.
And then when I started looking and I was like, wow, there's 3 or 4. And then the more in tune I came with the teachable moments, then, you know, 5, 10 years later, I'm like, there really are 100 teachable moments a day. But I think like anything else, it took practicing your craft and it took being intentional to look for those things to actually see them.
Yeah, that's awesome. When you do, when you are able to see those things and when you are able to share that with your team, and it does impact winning, and it may not impact winning. There may not be as a direct of a line as there is, well, okay, we improved our 3-point shooting percentage and that's easier to measure, whereas the intangible things are harder to measure. But in a lot of ways, I think they probably have at least an equal impact, if not a bigger impact in a lot of ways. Because when you build that kind of tight-knit team, it just makes everything fit together better in my experience. Both the teams I've played on and the teams I've coached that have had those intangible skills at a higher level, have just the teams have been better, and not just better on the win-loss record, but just it's a better experience for everybody, coaching staff, players, all the way around.
Yeah, for sure.
All right, let's jump into how you got involved with PGC basketball. Tell the story of how you first got involved with PGC, and then let's talk a little bit about what the mission of PGC is and what you guys have going.
Yeah, so and the way I got involved was right after we won our national Christian College national championship, the first one. It was a big deal for Emmanuel College, and I was speaking, doing some read and react stuff, and Dina Evans had told Mono Watsa, who's now the owner president of PGC, to come check a look at me, and you know, they heard a lot of good things, that kind of thing. So he came to clinic. I didn't even know why he was there, and we just started talking a little bit. And man, I mean, really for me, just like a God story. We were struggling, you know, financially. I took this job at Emmanuel kind of on a whim, and it didn't pay much. It was a big pay cut. My wife had to take a different job, big pay cut. We had a house in the 2007, 2008, in the market crash. We had a house back there. We were renting a house here, and we had just won a championship. My son had just gone to the hospital. They didn't know if he was going to make it. And, you know, we were just struggling. We had bills that we couldn't pay. And so we had had a successful season. They hadn't had a lot of successful seasons here. And people took notice. I got a job offer, about three times the pay, house, car, like really good benefits to it. On the way home, flying home, called my wife and said, "Hey, you know, I got a new job. We're good. We're going to be able to pay the bills," you know, that kind of thing. And right. I came home and my wife said, "You know, did you pray about it?" And I said, I didn't, but you know, when God swings the door open this wide, you just go through it. And
here we go.
Yeah. And she said, "Well, I'm okay with that as long as you," so that night I started to pray about it and I had already accepted the job. Next morning I woke up and I had no peace about it. And I called up to the AD and I said, "You know, I hate to do this because I gave you my word, but I didn't pray about it first, and I have, and I'm going to have to turn down the job." And they were like, "Why would you do that?" And I didn't know why I would do that, you know? And I remember I'm sitting on the sidewalk just with my head in my hands thinking, like, how in the world are we ever going to make it? And why does this make no sense to me? And we were about to foreclose on a house, and we were about to have a car repo. We just had hospital bills we couldn't afford. It was a nightmare, you know? And I felt as a failure as a man, felt like I couldn't provide for my family. And I was afraid to tell my wife all, you know, she knew, but she didn't know all of it. And I was scared to tell her because I didn't want to let her down. And you know, I just remember that day just kind of like giving it all up and saying, "Here's where we're at, and I'm a failure." And, you know, my wife, obviously, she talked me out of that, and she said, "No, you're not. You know, you've done the best you can. You've worked hard, and it just hasn't worked." And, you know, she was by my side, and we just prayed together, and we said, "We don't know why we just gave up what we just gave up." And literally within 24 hours, PGC called and said, "Hey, listen, we want you to come work for us, and here's what we want you to do." And I had no idea they were going to call me. I had no idea what they were going to offer. I was thinking, you fast forward, you know, 10 years down the road, I'm with PGC, director of coach development. It's offered me not only, you know, opportunities to change a lot of lives. It's offered the opportunity to mentor a lot of coaches. It's given me the opportunity, a platform that I could have never imagined, leading into the Hardwood Hustle with our podcast, the platform that's given me. The platform of coaching. And so, you know, God had an amazing plan, and I was on the other side of it thinking there was no plan, you know. And so it was just really one of those crazy, miraculous stories in my life where I had thought, man, I don't know why we would be doing this. But within 24 hours, you know, God showed up and said, "Hey, here's why you chose what you chose."
If you're a basketball coach in the greater Cleveland area and you have a passion for teaching the game and might be interested in joining the Head Start Basketball Camp coaching staff this summer, please reach out to us via email at headstartbasketball@usa.net.
Yeah, that's amazing. I think it goes to a lot of times in life when a door opens and a door closes and then another one opens, and you just have to be ready to accept what that mission is to be able to go and make what you feel is the right decision. And sometimes, you know, you go with your gut, you go with what, you know, your higher power tells you. And it ended up obviously being a very good decision for you. And you've had a lot of success both at Emmanuel and with PGC. So talk a little bit about what your role is currently and maybe how that's evolved over the time you've been at PGC.
Yeah, you know, I mean, originally I got in and I directed some of our summer sessions where we, you know, teach players the intangibles. We teach them how to become better players, how to think the game. And I did that for a couple of years. And then eventually we recognized that we were doing our best to like change a lot of young people's lives. But we recognized also there was another platform out there. You know, our mission at PGC is to be a light in the basketball world. And we're trying to make a difference. We're trying to make an impact. And we recognize that we were impacting players, but you know, every coach has 15 players this year, 15 players the next year. And we realized there's such a multiplier effect that we could have if we can actually affect coaches. And so then we started the coach development portion of PGC. And that's what I'm in charge of and take care of. I do some external partnerships and things like that. But my primary focus and love is how can we affect and how can we help coaches? And so we continue to look for the best products, the best ways, the best teachings, the best webinars, podcasts, anything that we can do to impact coaches. You know, that's our mission, is what can we do to be a light in the basketball world. And we do that on the players end through our summer sessions and all the stuff we offer. And we've branched out into what we do for coaches now with our coaches clinics and so on, to try and be, you know, to be a light to basketball coaches all over the world.
So talk about what makes the PGC Glazier clinics maybe a little bit different from the average coaches clinic that somebody would go to. What do you guys feel that you do really well at that makes it a valuable proposition for coaches to come and attend one of your clinics?
Yeah, you know, I think, you know, at PGC, we've done a couple different types of clinics, and I think all of the clinics have different values to them. I think the value of PGC Glazier was multiple speakers, you know, because a lot of times, you know, I was go to the Nike clinics when I was, you know, coming up, and, you know, you have, you know, 10 speakers. There's nothing wrong with them. You just have 10 speakers and you're going to hear what you're going to hear. You know, if they're doing zone offense, that's what you're going to hear. And if there's, you know, but you might be set in your ways on some things that you want to do. And, you know, if you go to PGC Glazier, you know, if you didn't want to hear zone offense, you might come over here and hear culture. If you don't want to hear culture, you might want to hear practice drills, but there's three or four speakers going at a time. And so there's always something for every coach. And also the camaraderie, you know, that you sense of those things. I mean, coaches trying to help coaches. I think those are two things that are pretty special.
So what are you doing now day in, day out with PGC here? So this summer, like what's your work schedule like for them in terms of what you're doing?
Yeah. So two things. I mean, one thing, I'll fly around the country to our sessions and just meet with coaches and just support them. So, you know, if we got 20 coaches a session in Colorado, and I'll go out there and spend a day with them, just helping any way I can, answering questions. So I go to different sessions. And then the other major thing is we have some new initiative coming out, you know, here pretty soon. And, you know, it's going to be a platform to be able to help coaches deeper and we've ever been able to help them. And I think, you know, a lot of the things that we talked about before, like giving them a map and giving them a way and some more age stage appropriateness and like, what do I need to be teaching? How do I need to be building practices? We've got a really cool thing out here that I think is going to put it in a position for coaches they've never heard it before, and an ability to learn it in a way they've never learned it before, and to say that, you know, listen, here's what I need to be efficient in to be a great coach. I don't think anybody's ever systematically put that out there. We're going to do that. Here's what you need to be a great coach. Here's how you need to do it. And here's the aids to help you get there. Not that it's the only way to skin the cat, but it's going to give some people some clear direction that desire to be great coaches. And so, you know, I'll have more on that, you know, later this summer, but we've been working on that for about a year now, and we're really excited about what it is and what it's going to be and how we think we can impact coaches.
That sounds very cool. It's going to be geared. The curriculum going to be geared to one particular, like high school coaches, or are you going to have sort of different tiers for somebody who's maybe a youth coach, somebody who's a high school coach, college coaches? How's that going to break out?
Yeah, it's going to be, you know, there's going to be a lot of facets to it. There's going to be a lot of live interaction. There's going to be a lot of places where we get together. There's also going to be things you can do on your own. There's going to be a whole bunch of different things to it. But throughout those, you'll be able to understand like what is the starting point and what's the next point that I need to go to and what's age stage appropriate. So you're going to be able to kind of take your own journey based on what level of coach you are. And some things will be applicable to you and some things won't. And we'll outline that this will make sense at this age or this won't make sense. And so coaches can kind of go if they're going to move up the ranks as go as kids get older, if they're going to stay specialized in a certain age, they'll be able to take their own journey.
So is that going to be like a membership model? Is that kind of what you're thinking of? Or how's that going to play out? If I'm a coach and I would want to get involved in it when it comes out, what's that going to look like from my end as a coach that's interested in what you're talking about?
Yeah, you know, we're still working on that a little bit, but it's something like that in a membership setting. The thing is that, you know, we're going to slow roll it a little bit. Like we're not going to just open it up and let anybody get into it in the first few months and the first year, whatever, because we want to make sure that we're serving the people within the group well. And so, we're going to kind of tier it and make sure that, you know, one of our goals is always to be excellent in things that we do. And we're cautious, you know, maybe we could open it to the world and make more money in the first month or 2 months, but we don't want to just make money. We want to do things better and we want to make an impact. And so we're going to kind of slow roll that opportunity for people to get in, to be able to go and grow with us, to make sure that we're serving everybody that's in the group that's trying to grow as a coach.
Yeah, that sounds awesome. I mean, I think anytime you're a coach and now you can go out on the internet and you can find lots of different resources from different sources and whatever. But I think as a coach, one of the challenges is always trying to figure out how do you incorporate those things into your program, your philosophy? How do I organize it? So yeah, I can find a drill. I can find a communication activity that I can do at the end of practice, but how does that all fit together into a cohesive plan to really help me have success both on and off the court with my players? And it sounds like that's sort of the direction you guys are heading.
Yeah, absolutely. And addressing some of the things we were talking about earlier, like, you know, what is the next step? Like, what does it actually look like when we talk about, I mean, you can hear, you know, any number of talks on the internet about culture, you know, but where people have a hard time is, well, how do I actually build that, right?
Absolutely.
What do I do? What's step one, step two, and step three? And, you know, and that's what we're attempting to do, is to just really empower the coach to be able to just grow and not just, you know, it's great. I love how much coaches are willing to share, and I love how much information is out there. I think it's wonderful. But the thing is missing is what you alluded to, is like, well, but what do I do with this? You know, and how do I apply this? And does it even apply to me? Is this even right for this? And that's what we want to try and help coaches to do, is just to take that journey with them and say, hey, here's a good next step for you. And this will make sense at this age group. And yeah, we know everybody's doing that, but if you want to be an impactful coach, you're going to want to stay away from this and do this. And so that's what we're going to attempt to do. And it's been a lot of fun trying to figure out how we can serve.
How many people have been involved in the development of that program?
Oh man, a big portion of our PGC team and some of the outsider influences that we've called on a lot of lifelong coaches that have been doing it for a while. Been doing it or retired from the game, and it's still a work in progress and still will be for a while. But we're just incorporating as many good minds as we possibly can. And there's still areas we need to explore more and find, hey, who's doing it really well at this age, who's doing it really well there, and then just kind of pulling on all of our different backgrounds and experiences within our PGC team.
That all makes sense to me. Let's jump to the third leg of what you do, and that's the hardwood hustle. So talk a little bit about, A, how you first got involved in it, because you initially were the halftime guest, and then eventually took over when Alan left, took over the host position. So talk a little bit about just the experience of getting on there and how much fun it's been to be able to go through. And I know I've had a blast doing this particular podcast, and I'm sure you're enjoying that. And again, this is another opportunity for you to be able to impact people. So talk a little bit about that experience with the Hardwood Hustle.
Yeah, you know, I mean, you pretty much outlined it. I mean, in the beginning, we just had so much going on with PGC, and they said, hey, can you add a little value to halftime? We said, yeah, let's, you know, if there's an opportunity to serve coaches. And, Then Adam and Alan decided they were going to go do different things. Alan wanted to go do his own, podcast, and had some other things that he wanted to get into. And so in that time, I honestly was just being a support to Adam and like, hey, what's next for you? What are you going to do? Are you going to continue the podcast? And he was just really unknown about what he was going to do. And at the time, I really felt like I had too much going on to even think about that. But then, one day we just started talking. He said, I could really see you, being on this podcast. You add so much value to this and all of that. I was like, well, I don't know, I don't know. And so then we just tried a couple, to see how it would go and to see if it would work. And, then I found myself just really enjoying being able to share things with coaches. I don't know if I have the best, podcast, radio voice or whatever, but when we start getting into these conversations, we start talking about serving players and serving coaches, even if I'm tired, even if whatever, I just find myself getting really re-energized saying, this is an opportunity to serve and to help. And not that I have all the answers, but I've made enough mistakes. I was thrown into the fire at the age 23 as a head college coach. I've made enough mistakes to have learned from. And so there's a bit of knowledge to be able to help. And more importantly, it's not really what I know that I think is going to be able to help coaches. It's what I love. Like I love what I do. I love the podcast. I love PGC. I love coaching at Emmanuel. And my real, I guess, why behind it is I want coaches to love doing what they're doing. I want them to be passionate about it. And there in turn, players are going to love their experience because their coaches love and are so passionate about it. And so I think that's the one thing that I want to get across to coaches more than anything is I just want to help them find ways. And some people don't love it because of the parents are ruining the experience for them. Some people don't love it because the coaches ruin the experience. Some people don't love it because they don't know how to navigate this particular problem. Some people don't there's a multitude of reasons people aren't enjoying or are passionate about what they're doing in coaching basketball. And I want to help overturn those rocks and figure out, hey, well, here's how you can get rid of that so you can enjoy what you're doing and make a bigger impact every day.
Well, I'll say number one, that love definitely comes through. When I listen to the Hardwood Hustle, there's no question that love of the game comes through. And then number two, the thing that I like about what you said is it's not so much about you providing all the answers. And I sort of feel the same way as we got into doing this show last June, and we just recorded our 100th episode the other day.
Congratulations.
Yeah, thank you. It's kind of amazing. And never would have guessed that it's gone where it's gone and just the great people that we've been able to have an opportunity to talk to. And again, I think the first basketball podcast I honestly listened to was Alan and Adam. And I remember listening to the show in the car with my son, who was probably now that's 4 or 5 years ago now. So he was maybe in third or fourth grade driving to a tournament and saying, hey, we're going to listen to this show. And, you kind of get to feel, I'm sure you know this, that when people listen to you, they kind of feel like they know you, even though you don't know them and you've never met them. So they come up and they're like, hey, TJ, how you doing?
Yeah, absolutely.
And you're like, they know all your kids' names and they know what your family's doing and you don't know any of them. And so I kind of felt that way, with Alan and Adam, and then got a chance through some different situations to meet Alan and kind of get to be friends with them. And so it's kind of one of those things. It's sort of amazing that, that happened. And so I guess my greater point here is that it's not that you or I or anybody who's hosting the shows are pontificating and trying to come across as experts. I think what we do a really good job of is creating a dialogue with the people who are the guests. And then through that dialogue, you share something, I share something, and then a coach who's out there listening kind of takes what we say and, spins it their own way or thinks about it or interprets it or maybe changes something or picks up one new idea. And to me, that's what's really exciting is when you see and you have these conversations and then people write into you or people share with you, hey, we tried this, or hey, I reached out to this person. We just had something happen to us the other day where one of the people that listened to the show wrote to us and said, hey, we reached out to a coach, Matt Hattie, who's in Iowa. He's a girls coach. And we reached out to him after listening to his podcast. And then we had a conversation with him about I wanted to pick his brain about the defense that he talked about on your show. And the two of them had a conversation for, a half hour where they talked about some of the things that, he had talked about on the show. And those kinds of connections to me are what it's all about.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. It has. It's been a really amazing journey, and the people that you get to meet and, the emails that you get, like, I know we don't always, a lot of times we're just planting seeds, but then when you get to get out on the road or you get to get these emails back and to know that you're making an impact. I think for anybody, that's just a really rewarding experience, you know, just to know that you could do that. And man, if I put 1,000 hours into it, but it affected one or two people, I'd count it worth it. And I think along the line, I've learned just as much as I've given in that, from responses, from emails, from other people chiming in on things I do. And so I count it a really valuable experience. Not only do I get to share, I get to learn as well.
Yeah, absolutely. So let me ask you this related to putting the show together. What's the biggest challenge for you personally in putting together the show or being on the show? What's your biggest challenge?
You know, to be honest with you, I mean, Adam's really good. I'm not the most organized guy. Like Adam's really good at organizing and coming up with topics. And I'm much better at just going off the cuff. Like, you want to talk hoops, you want to talk about parents and sports, you want to talk about, like, I feel passionate about that stuff, you know? And so when we get going, I think that that's probably the gift that I bring to it, is that, you know, I think I have some opinions or some views that have some thought behind them and some why behind them. And Adam does a great job of organizing those and getting good topics for us to be able to talk about and to be able to share, you know? And so I think probably one of the hardest things is making sure that it's usable. Like, one of the things I always want to walk away from is not that I just vented or I did it. I want them to have something maybe they could take away from it. And so ensuring there's something that made them better is one of the things I'm always shooting for.
Yeah, that's 100% right. Is when you can bring that passion to what you're doing and you're sharing and you're excited about what your topic is, it's not, again, like I said earlier, it's not that you're coming down off the hill as the expert. It's, hey, we're creating a dialogue. Here's my opinion. Here's my thought process. Here's the why behind my opinion. And then it generates a dialogue between people, either A, who are the guests on the show, or even more importantly, that audience that's out there. What do you think you've improved on the most from a podcasting standpoint since you started? And one of the things that I feel like for me is, you know, when I first sat down in front of that microphone and it went live and we're trying to record, and you really find out whether or not you're able to speak smoothly. And so that's one of the things that I feel like I've gotten a lot better at over the course of time, is just being more comfortable behind the mic and learning how to conduct an interview. So talk a little bit about just your behind the mic experience.
Yeah. Well, first of all, you do an absolutely wonderful job, and really easy to speak to. And I think Adam does a really good job of that as well, and does a really good job of speaking to that. I think probably one of the things that I've gotten better at over time is letting my guard down and letting my passion come through, you know, and not a passion to be right or to be wrong, but just a passion that you can hear, like, this is important, you know? And I think I tried to be a little bit prim and proper in the beginning and make sure I sounded right and I did right. But I think my best work for me on the podcast comes when I just let my heart, you know, show. And I say, this is how I really feel. And here's the things I really think you can do. And here's the things that I've learned. And, you know, here's the things that I'm continuing to learn. And here's where I failed, and being vulnerable and letting them know, hey, these are, you know, those are the type of things that, I think took a little bit of time for me to recognize, of just putting myself out there to the audience and really letting my true self shine through.
Yeah, it's very true. I think you, at first, you kind of want to present a certain image to the world. And as you get into it more, you realize that the more authentic you can be, the more valuable what you're doing becomes to both the audience and to the guests that you're interacting with. Let me wrap up with this final question. I guess it's a two-part question. One, where do you guys see the Hardwood Hustle going in the future? And then, is there a guest out there, somebody maybe that's kind of off the radar that you guys would like to have on, or that you personally would like to have on at some point in the future that you haven't been able to get to yet?
Yeah, really good question. So as far as where do I see it going, you know, I don't know that we've really dove into that. As long as it's a platform, we just see it moving forward, you know? I mean, if we can be a help, then it needs to keep going. If we're serving people, if we're helping coaches become better, if we're helping players become better, then we just need to keep doing it. And I think each day we kind of approach it like that. If it's serving and they're listening, then let's keep serving. Specifically for me, guest-wise, if I could pick any guy to get or any gal to be on here, I think I'm going Tony Bennett at Virginia. you know, I've heard him speak before, heard him a lot of different things, but just unbelievably impressed with him in so many realms of how he shows up as a human being, how he shows up as a coach. You know, he's one guy that sit down and have a conversation with, I think would be really, really a lot of fun.
Yeah, I think he's proven himself to be such a stand-up person when you think about some of the things that he said after obviously very difficult loss last year, and just the way he's handled himself in those situations, I think speaks a lot to the type of character that he has and that he's passed along to the players. We've been fortunate enough to have Joe Harris, the NBA three-point champion, his father, Joe, who was a longtime high school coach out in the state of Washington and actually coached the younger Joe in high school. And we've been fortunate enough to have him on the show, and he has just tremendous things to say about Tony Bennett and the experience that his son had while he was there at Virginia. So I think that's a very good choice. TJ, before we wrap up, I want to give you a chance to share out your contact information, share out how people can reach out to you and find out more about some of the things you're doing. And then if there's anything else that we didn't touch on during our hour and 20 minutes or so, please feel free to share that out before we wrap up.
Yeah. I mean, I just, you know, thanks first of all, just for having me. It's been a pleasure to sit here and talk the game and what we can do to make the game better. I really enjoyed that. And I think kudos to all of your people that are listening. Like, you typically come to a podcast like this because you want to get better. And I always have the utmost respect for anybody that wants to get better. And so just kudos to your audience for listening. And you can find me on social, Twitter, at Coach TJ Rosine. That's at Coach TJ Rosine. You know, try and tweet out helpful things. It's a place where you can find me. At the Hardwood Hustle, Hardwood_Hustle is our Twitter handle. And I know we got some Instagram stuff like that, but Adam, you're gonna have to ask Adam about all that. I don't know where all that is, but our Hardwood Hustle podcast on iTunes or wherever you find podcasts, we'd love to have you listen to that. And for all of you that are coaches or have athletes, we'd love for you to send them out to PGC basketball. I think you'd be really happy with what you saw there and the experience that you'd have. So, you know, those are some ways that you can keep in touch. Those are some ways you can, you know, kind of listen to our podcast and, you know, enjoy listening to your podcast. And, I think we're all in this for the same reason. That's to serve coaches. And there's never too many of those, you know. I mean, I feel this the way about this one that I do about these crime mysteries. I drive to work and I listen to crime mysteries all the time. If I'm not listening to a basketball podcast, and there's never enough of those, man, I'm always looking for the next good mystery.
I hear you. Yeah. I spend a lot of time. My commute and my job, I spend like 45 minutes, 50 minutes every day back and forth. And that's where I really got turned on to podcasts. And Hardwood Hustle is one of the very first ones from a basketball standpoint that I started listening to. And then slowly I'm always expanding my repertoire of ones that I try to listen. I bounce back and forth between sports and business and crime.
Yeah.
So I'm right there with you.
Awesome.
I'm right there with you. Well, TJ, one more time, I can't thank you enough for being willing to jump on with us here today. We really do appreciate it. And to everyone out there, we will catch you on our next episode. Thanks.
Head Start Basketball's Player Development Academy offers Cleveland area players a unique opportunity to improve their basketball skills. Regardless of a player's age, skill level, or position, training with Head Start Basketball will elevate your game to the next level. Do you want to improve your ball handling, become a better shooter, or develop into a more skilled, confident player? Our academy classes offer training that's designed to do just that. Our training sessions are innovative and will have you learning skills that are transferable to actual games. We have 4 different class skill levels for boys and girls, ages 4 and up. All Player Development Academy classes will be held at the Strongsville Recreation Center. For more information or to get registered, please visit www.headstartbasketball.com.
Thanks for listening to the Hoopheads podcast, presented by Head Start Basketball.